Surviving the Long Emergency.
Now, I'm not talking about where everything in the world just stops and we're thrown into the Stone Age, but I am talking about significant disruptions where what we've taken for granted for all of our lifetimes may well not be available for significant periods of time.
That's Matthew Stein. We spend the hour talking with him about his book, When Technology Fails. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My birthday was last week. My son and his wife know I've got climate change on the brain, so they gave me a global warming coffee cup. It's got a map of the world on it. When you pour in hot water or coffee, it shows the world's coastlines shrinking. Florida disappears, as do most of the Gulf Coast states, except Texas. So does Manhattan, Long Island, and Massachusetts, where I produce this program, has a huge chunk taken out of it. We don't know when this will happen, only that it will, if we continue to do business as usual. And huge changes are already underway that will transform life as we know it, ready or not. My guest, Matthew Stein, wants to help us get ready. His book, When Technology Fails, is a guide to surviving what he calls the long emergency, one created by the convergence of peak oil, climate change, and the depletion of all kinds of resources from overpopulation. Stein gets down to the granular level, from basic survival skills in a natural disaster to green building, alternative healing, and living locally when global trade has collapsed. He tells us what kind of bugs to eat for protein when there's no food around, how to make our own medicines, and how to live off the grid. But When Technology Fails isn't just for survivalists. Matt Stein also has some ideas about policies that can get us off from business as usual and hopefully mitigate some of the worst disasters his book warns us about. Matt Stein developed some of his survival skills out of his experiences as a serious hiker. He also has to think about survival because of where he lives.
I'm in California, Lake Tahoe area, Truckee specifically, which is where the Donner Party had their famous barbecue about 150 years ago.
Wow, now those were survivalists.
Yeah, well, some of them did actually an admirable job. Some of the families didn't, nobody died and nobody had to eat each other, and other families didn't do so well. And had they known that they could peel bark and eat the green layer like deer do when they're starving, then they would have done a little better.
Well, hopefully we don't have to do that. Your excellent book, When Technology Fails, would be a wonderful guide for anyone, whether they were trying to struggle over a snowy mountain pass or try to deal with a crisis that met them right in their own suburban neighborhood. You open this book by saying technology will fail. You can count on it. Apart from the temporary failures like hurricanes and earthquakes, do you really think that technology will fail us in a more long-lasting way?
I see that the combined future problems we're facing with the decline in world's oil production combined with global climate change pretty much guarantees that you're going to have substantial failures of technology. Now, I'm not talking about where everything in the world just stops and we're thrown into the Stone Age, but I am talking about significant disruptions where what we've taken for granted for all of our lifetimes, you know, except for people who lived through World War II and the Depression, perhaps, meaning that food is always available, you can always go to the store, buy what you want, you can always go to the gas station, pump what you want. Those kinds of things may well not be available for significant periods of time.
And what kind of significant periods of time?
Well, in my book, I help people to prepare and deal with everything from minor meltdowns to major long-term, like for months at a time, things aren't working well in our world. And I'm hoping that I never see those months at a time where there's no potable water in the tap, you can't fill up your gas at the gas station, the lights don't turn on. But I believe that there's a significant possibility that that will happen. Now, a lot of that depends on choices we make. And certainly with the new administration, I'm much more positive that we might make the right choices to prevent those kinds of long-term failures and potential all-out collapse. But it's not, like Obama says, it's not easy choices, and it's not going to be quick and simple fixes.
In fact, you say that the system, at least as it is now, has failure built into it. What do you mean by that?
Well, as an engineer, I'm trained. I have an MIT degree in Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering. And when I started researching my book, I had considered myself to be quite ecologically aware and up on these things. And as I did more and more research, I realized that our systems were closer to systemic collapse on this planet than I had previously imagined. And what I mean by that is when you look at all of the current trends right now in terms of the fish in the ocean, the climate change, what we're doing in the atmosphere in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and chopping down trees in the planet, which are a major factor in the weather cycles on the planet, all of those trends, and if we continue doing business the way we're doing it right now, they all end in out-and-out collapse, systemic collapse. Now, I'm not saying that we can't make major changes in this planet to avoid that, but I'm saying right now, in 30 years, all the major fisheries in the oceans will be dead unless we do things differently. In 30 years, our climate will be drastically changed unless we do things differently. In 30 years, most of the world's remaining rainforests will be gone, except for places that have been protected by isolated parks. Those things all lead to systemic collapse. So doing the things we're still doing, there's a definition of insanity that some people say, which is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So if we keep doing what we're doing now, the scientific, unavoidable conclusion is collapse.
You know, and it's a sad thing, a sad comment, but in the New York Times yesterday, on the day that we're conducting this interview, the Times had a report that people are out of sync with Obama on his awareness of climate change. In other words, they don't think it's a big deal.
Well, you know, I was on the beach in Santa Cruz last week, and it was 78 degrees in the shade, and on the beach in the sun and the sand, it was almost 90 degrees. Now, that's January, the middle of January, and I have never in my life been on the beach in the middle of January in Northern California when it's been almost 90 degrees in the sun. Now, I see direct results here. I live in the High Sierras near Lake Tahoe, and the fire seasons get scarier and scarier and scarier as the years go on. I mean, last summer, we had a huge lightning storm that covered most of Northern California, 60,000 lightning strikes. There was something like 10,000 to 20,000 small fires started. We had probably 30 or 40 major fires going in Northern California at the same time. And there was parts that were unlivable, just totally choked in smoke. In my mind, this is a direct result of global warming. Now, some might say that global warming isn't happening due to human nature, you know, human actions, and that it's happening due to changes in the cosmos and the radiation from the sun and other effects. And I personally believe it's a combination of both, but I don't believe that the physics behind greenhouse gases is wrong. I believe that that is right. So I'm seeing changes in the time I've lived in this area for 25 years. They're radical. So I think it's a huge issue, and when you project the changes out into the future, they're devastating. One of the things many people don't realize that could be the most devastating change of all is that as we pump more carbon into the atmosphere, it falls to Earth in terms of acid rain. And those acid rains are changing the pH level, the acidity of the oceans. And what we're seeing is that we're getting radically more acid in the oceans, and that can lead to collapse of the food chain from the bottom up, where the planktons in the ocean, if it's too acidic, then it dissolves the shells, the little calcium shells in the planktons, and they die, and the coral reefs die. and the bottom of the food chain falls out and the oceans die. So we're looking at systemic collapse, unimaginable if we keep doing business the way we're doing. Now, in my book, half of the book is about green and healthy living and sustainability and how can we do the right thing to avoid collapse in our planet. And I believe it's doable. Not easy, but doable. You know, defeating Hitler was a difficult task, and it never would have happened if it was number 10 on the world's priority list. And I believe that avoiding collapse is a difficult task, more difficult than defeating Hitler. But I believe that we could mobilize the United States and mobilize the world to do this. But we must make it a number one priority. It can't be number 10 on the priority list or isn't going to happen.
And your book is a wonderfully comprehensive way to do that. I'm talking with Matthew Stein. His book is When Technology Fails. It's a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency. Now, you lay out four major threats. One of them you've already talked about, the eco threat, and of course there are many more aspects to it, but that's good enough what we've covered right there. It's scary enough. You also talk about peak oil, the bio threat, and terror. Give us some examples of how technology could fail us in each one of these.
Our world's economy really is greased and runs on oil right now, because oil is the single most energy-dense, easily used material. You know, you can pump it from here and there in pipelines. You can fill your car up and carry its own little energy supply with you. To give you an idea of what that oil is doing for our world, right now in America, the average American has the equivalent, energy equivalent of 50 slaves at his beck and call 365 days a year. So in other words, the average American is consuming primarily from oil, but coal also. We're using the energy equivalent of having 50 little slaves at our beck and call every day, 365 days a year. So what that's doing then is providing us with a relatively easy lifestyle where that energy that we're using in terms of fossil fuels is doing a huge amount of work. Imagine if all of a sudden the equivalent of 50 slaves working for you every day are gone, and you have to start doing that on your own. That's a huge failure of technology. Now, we just saw in the last 6 months, many people believe that this economic collapse was not created, but it was what pushed it over the edge with the economic collapse of the banking system and real estate and all of those was the fact that oil went from, you know, 10 years ago it was $10 a barrel, and then this year it was hovering between $110 and $140 a barrel. And it was pretty clear that, quite simply, our economy just wouldn't work well with that kind of high price. Now, it's easy to say the blame is on the guys that were speculating on oil, but there's something else behind that. And what that is that peak in world oil production. There is a natural life cycle to every oil well and every oil field. You know, you find a field, you start developing, you put wells in, you put more wells in. Then over time, those wells don't start producing so well. So instead of just putting more wells, you have to start doing things like pumping air or seawater down the wells to try and force the oil up. Now what's happened is that all the world's major oil fields are now in decline. And we've been discovering new oil at a rate of about a seventh of the rate of what we're actually using it at. So that's kind of like going out and charging $100,000 on your credit cards every year and paying off, you know, $15,000. I mean, how long can you keep that up before you're in serious trouble? So what many people don't realize is that regular, easy-to-process oil, black crude oil, peaked. The production of that actually peaked worldwide in about 2005, 2006. Now, the reason that none of us really saw a crisis at the fuel pumps is that we've been doing the harder-to-get stuff. We've been processing oil, tar sands in Alberta and tar sands in Venezuela, and we've been ramping up biofuels around the world and ethanols and biodiesels. And those have kind of filled in the gap for where the regular oil's been dropping. But the problem is, those fuels are much more expensive to process than just pumping easy-to-get crude out of the ground. So as the price in oil is dropping, we all say, God, this is great. You know, gas is under $2 a gallon again, and now I can, you know, it's like the crisis is over, and see, these guys were just speculating and there was no problem. Well, that's wrong. It's like the speculating caused a temporary bump upwards, and now it's crashed downwards. But we've got a serious issue coming up in 2 to 3 years from now, because what's happening is most of the projects for development in oil, the new oil fields, the harder to get oil fields, the deep ocean wells, the far Arctic wells, those are expensive projects, the tar sands in Alberta, and they take a lot of capital investment. And with the world financial crisis, that money's just drying up. So what it means is
that might be the best thing for the planet, though.
It's probably best for the planet, but it means that our breathing space with low oil prices is a short-lived breathing space, because you're going to see problems maintaining even the decreased production we're seeing now is going to be problems. So the only solution long-term is getting off of oil, is developing the alternatives, is developing the new technologies, the super-efficient cars, is diversifying in our energy portfolio so that we're not so dependent on oil. And it's certainly the best for the planet.
Well, you know,
and it's also the only way we can avoid collapsing the economy in a few years.
Right. You know, some people say, well, with global warming, the Arctic will open up and so will these huge new oil fields. But then the point you made earlier about the acidification of the oceans, you know, some people are talking about using algae, in fact, as a biofuel. But if the oceans are dead, there isn't going to be a whole lot of algae left.
Well, an algae has huge potential because it can convert, theoretically, it can convert energy, the sun's energy, into biofuels and sequester carbon. In other words, it's not totally sequestered in that the algae takes carbon out of the atmosphere, which is great, and then you burn it and you release it back to the atmosphere, but at least it's more of a carbon neutral process there because you're recycling it. Atmosphere comes out to the algae, gets burned, goes back, kind of like burning wood. Problem with algae is that it's a technically difficult thing to control and manage. Algae tend to get polluted with other organisms that like to eat the algae, and all of a sudden your algae farm is like dead. So they haven't really figured out how to economically do this right. But I'm not saying it's not solvable. I'm just saying it's not that easy. There's a lot of people working on it, and they're making some good progress, and it has some really excellent potential. But it's not like, oh, we can just all grow algae and everything's going to be fine and we can run our cars just the way we did and no problem. All of these things are solvable, but it doesn't mean they're easy.
Well, that points out, you know, your book, Matthew Stein, your book, When Technology Fails, you know, I think a lot of people think that the solutions to the climate crisis are simply technology. But as you just pointed out, it's not so simple. You also show that 100 years ago, in some ways, we were much more resilient. You know, when the shift to electrification was already pretty advanced 100 years ago, society was much less vulnerable to the failures of technology. I can remember when I lived in West Virginia in the 1970s and 80s, which got electrified, by the way, only in the 50s. The people there still had outhouses and treadle sewing machines and wringer washers, all of which functioned without electricity. And they had hand pumps in their kitchens. But we are a far, far cry from those kinds of alternative, more primitive, non-electrified technologies now.
You know, in our times of our grandparents, there was somebody in each community who knew how to make, fabricate, or grow just about everything needed for a good, comfortable, you know, lifestyle. And we've forgotten most of that. So a good part of my book is kind of showing people how to do things those old ways, how to build a small hand pump for your well. It covers everything from the MacGyver kind of things you should have on hand so that in case there's a temporary meltdown that you can purify your water easily and you and your family have water to drink. And then also it shows you how to do things the old way. Like if none of that's available, how could you find a piece of pipe or barrel and make a sand filter so you could filter out Giardia and Cryptosporidium that could make you horribly ill and do that with totally low-tech technology. So it covers the gamut, and how to make shoes, how to tan leather. I mean, I'm hoping I don't have to go out and skin a deer and tan leather myself so that I can have decent shoes to wear. But at least I know how to do that, and at least the information is there. And so if push comes to shove someday, I don't say, oh, man, I sure wish I had that information, because now I'm in deep trouble right now because nothing's working and I don't know how to do anything.
Yeah, your book is really incredibly comprehensive. You go from an emergency survival kit that you can keep in your car to surviving nuclear war. Let's take the first one first. What is a grab-and-run kit, and what are some of the key items you need to have in it?
Well, grab-and-run kit, or 72-hour survival kit, basically says, I want to have these things in my on hand. I keep them in a large plastic tub, and then I also have a backpack on hand in case I live in earthquake and fire and wildfire country. So if I have to leave my house and the bridges are down, then the only way I could do it would be on my back. So I have to have the ability to carry it on my back. But also, I would rather throw it in my car and drive down the road. But, you know, that option may not always be there. So it covers the basics for food, water, medicines that you and your family might need for the critical first 3 days or more after a disaster, when you saw in Hurricane Katrina that people were counting on the feds coming in to bail them out. And when it's a huge event, like a Hurricane Katrina or like a Kobe, Japan earthquake, you know, nobody's coming to bail you out. You've got to fend for yourself. So one of the most important things is a good backcountry filter, so that, like an MSR K-9 filter. And I talk about specific brands. I design these kinds of things as an engineer, and so I give people recommendations for what brands are best. And what that means is you can go into any scummy ditch or duck pond and stick that filter tip in there and pump water into a water bottle and have clean, sweet, safe drinking water for you and your family. And so that's like the most important item, because most of us could live for a month without food. You may not believe it, you may not like it, but you could really do it. But 3 days without water in severe hot temperatures, and you're going to start dying. And 1 day without water when the temperature is hot, and you're going to be really totally miserable. And you're going to drink out of that duck pond or that ditch water, scummy ditch, if that's the only thing you have available. And personally, I would much rather run it through my filter first. And then I also have backup items. Like I always have a first aid kit, and in my grab and run, I carry a small, compact backcountry backpacking first aid kit, and I supplement that always with 1.5 inch cloth tape. And the reason I have cloth tape is that if you're walking down the road and you're not used to walking, then chances are after the first mile or so, you're going to start to blister up on your heels. And if you don't have something to tape on your heels, like moleskin or cloth tape, then you're going to not be going anywhere once those heels blisters pop and your heels become raw. And the cloth tape is excellent for binding wounds, for, you know, if you have to, it's strong enough if you have to kind of use it to hold together something that's torn or broken, you can do that. So it's excellent.
You're talking about duct tape.
No, it's adhesive. It's first aid tape, 1.5 inches. Mm-hmm. I prefer the cloth tape. I've been a rock climber for years, I use it to tape my hands in severe climbs to keep my hands from getting all torn to pieces. And it's good for binding wounds. It's good for, you know, first aid. It's good for taping your heels and quick repairs. And I also actually like to have a little bit of the filament tape in there, too, that's like super strong fiberglass tape. So that's really better for repair jobs than the cloth tape or duct tape. Duct tape's just not that strong, and it's not really good to use on your body.
And you also, you just said, well, you could survive without food if you needed to for several weeks even, but, you know, most of us don't want to. We're going to get pretty hungry. So when push comes to shove, you say that there are actually some bugs we can eat, and they taste pretty good.
Well, I'll go under them, but I wanted two more quick items that were critical for your grab-and-run kit. I mean, I have a list on my website, www.whentechfails.com, with a comprehensive list. But the two items you really want to have is, one is a headlamp, like a backcountry climber type headlamp, and it's waterproof and runs on LEDs, totally durable. And what that is, a flashlight that sticks on your head, so wherever your head turns, it lights your way and leaves your hands free. The other critical item is a colloidal silver generator, and most people have never heard of that, but what that does is it generates a charged silver particle in water, and it kills bugs in the water, and it also, if you drink it, it will kill all pathogenic bacteria, and it will deactivate viruses. So that colloidal silver may not act as fast as a good antibiotic, but it'll act against antibiotic-resistant bugs and any kind of, you know, if you have an epidemic going on and medicines aren't working well or you have no access to medicines, you make yourself some colloidal silver water and it'll keep yourself and your family healthy.
And you actually show how people can do it themselves, although I gather you can buy them as well.
That's correct. You can buy them on the Internet. I recommend a couple of different ones, and I show you how you can make it yourself with 3 9-volt batteries and some pure silver wire. So back onto the bugs. If push comes to shove, essentially, the same thing that works for your local bear or the robin works for people. You may not like it, but it does. So earthworms, for instance, are edible. I mean, I haven't actually eaten one. I hear they're not too bad.
You recommend it, but you haven't eaten it?
Well, you know, hey, it's like I haven't been on TV going out there eating the bugs. Now, I've eaten some edible plants, and I enjoy that. But I got to admit that eating grubs out of the local stump and eating earthworms, you know, if I was paying a lot of money to go on TV and do that, I would do that. Or if I was starving, I would do that. But just to prove to myself that I can do it, you know, I haven't yet.
Push hasn't come to shove enough for you.
Yeah, it hasn't. It hasn't come to shove enough for me yet. If I'm out hungry for a day, you know, I fasted for a week. I can handle a day out there without food, and I've gone a day without food in the backcountry, and you know, it's okay. I haven't said, now if I was a week without food, then yeah, I'd start looking at the salamanders and the newts, and I'd start looking at grasshoppers. You know, grasshoppers are pretty good. I see guys in Africa eating them as part of their diet, and you know, you pull the heads off and the wings and the legs off because they got pretty nasty barbs and they're pretty tough on the gut when you try to eat them, but I'd go for them, and I'd definitely go for the worms, and I'd definitely go for the grubs inside the local stump, just like the bear eats.
Yum.
Yeah. Now, another one that's a little more palatable, and it is mostly available, is that if you're really starving, the green layer of trees, you can peel the outer layer of bark back and eat the green layer of bark underneath, and you can make a flour out of that and kind of make pancakes out of that. And just like deer survive in starving areas and stripping bark off trees and eat it when there's no other food available in the far north, people can do that too. And so that's definitely an option that's available in most places, not out in the Great Plains, but in most places. So push came to shove, I would be peeling bark and eating the green layer too.
We're talking about survival here, but your book is really a lot more than a survivalist book. I mean, aside from the fact that it talks about more systemic solutions, which I want to get back to a little bit later. But first, I want to ask you about how does it differ from the survivalist mentality? And why does that mentality really not do the trick for us?
My book is about survival and preparedness for real people. And the survivalists do love my book, but this is a book that appeals to people on the far right and the far left and everyone in the middle who just wants to do the right thing for their family in case there's some emergency someday. So my book is really 6 different handbooks in one. It's a survival and preparedness handbook. It's a green and healthy living sustainability handbook. It's a Red Cross type first aid handbook. It's a guide to alternative healing. And it's a renewable energy guide, practical hands-on how-to primer for renewable energy, doing wind and solar and hot water and things like that for your home. And it's also a green building primer on how to build green. So it's this huge comprehensive guide, and then each chapter ends in a little resource guide, because even though the book is huge, it's like 8.5 by 11, 500-plus pages, I can't say everything about everything, so each chapter ends in a resource guide to the best books that someone else, if you want to go further on the subject covered by that chapter, or if you want to buy materials that are recommended in that chapter, I have a resource guide at the end to guide people further.
The book is When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. We're spending the hour with the author, Matthew Stein. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break. We got to stop. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking this hour with Matthew Stein about how to survive when climate change, peak oil, and resource depletion create a long emergency, demanding profound changes in the way we live. His book is When Technology Fails. Matthew Stein, you say that surviving technology's failure, whether that comes through, you know, a flood or a hurricane, or if that comes through ecological collapse, you say that it takes a particular attitude, and that might be even more important than the skills that you so abundantly guide us to in the book.
That's correct. It's a survivor attitude, and there's a particularly valuable exercise in the book that I'd like to share with you. And first, I'll talk about the survivor attitude a little. My father-in-law was—he died a few years back in his mid-80s, and he was an incredible survivor. He had a third-grade education. He didn't have a huge skill set. He was born during World War One. His parents died when he was a small child, and he was raised by a sister. Went to work at third grade because they said, "Hey, you know, you eat, and we're a poor family. We have no money, so you got to stop going to school and go out and work for a living to make, you know." I mean, imagine being in the third grade, finishing the third grade, and being told you had to go out and work full time so that you could eat something each day. Now, he was captured and tortured by Nazis as a resistance fighter in World War II. He ended up in the Indonesian Revolution. He had this sixth sense. He had that intuitive gut feel that guided him. And he was an incredibly positive person in spite of all of the hardships in his life. His favorite saying was, "Make you happy." And he just was a really joyful person. And that kind of attitude helps pull you through situations. Now, nature built into each and every human being the most incredible survival mechanism, and it's called your intuition. It's the gut feel. And in our society, we've been taught to sort of worship the rational left brain. And it's this right side of the brain that's the intuitive side that really can kind of see around corners and guide you. Like people in the World Trade Center said, like, you know, I was headed for the elevator and something inside me told me I had to go this way, and they went that way, and they, by listening to that inner voice, it guided them perfectly to that exact space where their life was saved. Now, let me give you an exercise called the pit of the stomach exercise for getting in touch with this. And this could save your life. It could help you make important decisions right now in your life, and it might make the critical life and death decision somewhere in your future. So it's called pit of the stomach. And what you do is say you're trying to decide. Maybe you're in a crisis situation. Say, well, do I go down the river or do I follow the ridge? You know, which way do I go? And what do I do here? You can't trust the mind. If the mind is changing its mind every 2 minutes, if it says 1 minute, well, I think I should go down the river, and 2 minutes later it says, no, I should go down the ridge. It's like, how can you trust that? You can't. So what you need to do then is you calm yourself, you take a few deep breaths, and it may take several, if you're in a bad situation, it may take a while before you can calm. But until you can feel the muscles in your stomach relax, in between your belly button and your rib cage, you've got to feel that center of the area, that center of your stomach, the pit of the stomach relax. Then make a picture in your mind of option A. Say it's, do I go down the river? Do I follow the river? And then when you make a picture, you're bypassing the thinking brain. You think in pictures instead of regular rational thought. And then feel the muscles, and if you feel them tighten up into a knot or a ball, then you know that that's a bad decision to make. Then start breathing again and say, okay, once you feel the muscles relax again, you feel calm again, deep breaths, offer a little prayer if you're spiritual, maybe pray to Jesus or Buddha or, you know, whatever you want. Then picture option B. Maybe it's, do I stay on the ridge? And then feel the stomach again. And if you feel it go into a knot, well, maybe that's not a bad thing to do. And let me give you an example of this. There was a guy from San Francisco, a high-tech worker, who was with his wife and child, and they were driving, I think, to Seattle. Anyway, they were on some back roads in Oregon. They got disoriented and lost on these dirt roads trying to take a shortcut, ran out of gas, had no cell phone coverage where they were. Finally, after a day or two of sitting there with his wife in the car, he just said, you know, I got to do something. I can't let my wife and child die out here in the wilderness. I got to make an effort. So in his mind, he thought, well, the rule is you follow the river, that the water will always take you to civilization, and that's That's the survival rule. So he did that, and he died. He got stuck in a steep canyon. He got cold. He froze. He died. Turned out they found his wife and daughter by tracking cell phone records and cell phone towers. They kind of located the general vicinity where they were and put a manhunt out, and they found the car in this remote dirt road out of gas, and they were rescued, and the husband died. And if he'd been in touch with the intuitive side, see, the intuitive side doesn't know rules. It just tells you what to do. Mm-hmm. It just knows what to do. And I've made critical decisions in my life when I really couldn't figure it out with my head. I've done this pit of the stomach exercise, and it works. It really works, and it's helped me make the right decision, even though sometimes it was the opposite of what my rational mind was telling me to do.
A kind of mindfulness.
It's a mindfulness, and it's sort of an accepting, it's sort of a surrendering, sort of saying, like, I don't know, I can't figure this out. Sort of like, you guide me now. That you, for some people, would be Jesus or God and maybe the Holy Spirit. But whatever it is, it's asking the higher power to come in and guide you. And you might just say, if you're scientifically said, you say, okay, it's just my intuition. I don't want to attach any spirit or anything to it. It's just my intuition. But it works.
Now, you had a spiritual experience that led you to write this book.
Yes, I did. I wrote this book it took me 3 years to do it. And back in 1997, you know, people say, well, why did you write this book? And to be honest with you, I'd never considered writing anything like this book in my life. But I have had a long-term practice of prayer and meditation, and I've been able to get solutions to difficult engineering problems and patentable solutions sometimes by kind of praying and asking for help when I know what I'm figuring with my head just wasn't really right. But back in 1997, I wasn't really looking for that. I just made a generic request for guidance and inspiration in my morning session of prayer and meditation, and I got a bomb dropped in my lap. I mean, I got a pictorial outline for my book, sort of like those storyboard outlines for movies when you see artists sketch out the different scenes of a movie. So I had, 20 or 30 pictures put on me instantaneously in meditation outlining my book from start to finish, sort of what it was supposed to cover in the scope of the book. And my first thought, to be honest with you, was like, no way. I can't do this. I don't know all this stuff. And I don't hear voices very often, you know, but the still small voice in my head said, well, nobody does. And it said, it kind of assured me that I had the skills and talents, and I get the inner and the outer assistance that I needed to complete the project if I chose to take it on. Well, I didn't just go quit my job and start writing the book. It took me a year to decide maybe I could do it. I ran the concept by the editor of the Whole Earth catalog, Howard Rheingold, and a friend of mine, Rick Sylvester, a writer, author, and extreme skier and climber, and they both thought it was great. And after a year, I thought, well, maybe I could do this, and I got a book, How to Write a Book Proposal, and I wrote a 200-page proposal and sold it to a publisher. And another year of when I finally got a contract, then I quit my job and racked up the credit cards and hired the artists and bought all the research books and worked 70 hours a week to do the book. So it was a huge project. And the one thing, a couple other things that internal voice said. Now, this is a 3-year project, and I'm just hearing this internal guidance clearly a few times during it. It indicated that in the near future, not so distant future, many, many people would be needing the information in the book. Now, realize when I got this intuitional bomb dropped on my lap, the world, .com was booming. Oil was at a 30-year low when you factored in inflation. Business couldn't be better in America. No one had heard of Y2K, which personally I never thought was going to do much anyways, and turned out to be that was the case. So here I get this semi-apocalyptic project dropped on me, but from the outside it looked like nothing, business couldn't be better and the world couldn't be better. So it was tough. Then the other thing the voice guided me to do was focus on the future of the world, which deals with sustainability and these issues that are plaguing our planet and that have the potential to be civilization busting issues that take us down. Because I was focusing on my sample chapters on areas that I was comfortable with, like green building and renewable energy and alternative healing, areas of interest for the last 25 years. And the voice said, no, you've got to focus on the future of the world chapter because that's critical.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. But I think before we do, one last thing, before we actually leave the techniques, because I had a big question about them, and this is a very comprehensive book, you know, everything from how to survive a short-term emergency to the destruction of the planet. It's When Technology Fails, and I'm talking with the author, Matthew Stein. It takes a lot of time and money to learn the techniques, and I guess I have two questions. One is, can you learn the techniques that you have from a book, or do you actually need to go out and practice them? And if you don't have a whole lot of disposable income, like fewer and fewer of us have these days, how can you get around that?
Well, you can learn a lot from the book, and certainly practicing is highly recommended. Like, it doesn't take very much to get out to get some camping gear and to start going out in the backcountry. And I think one of the most important, if you're going to, a lot of these things you don't have to practice. Like, you don't have to practice how to build a sand filter. Like, if push comes to shove someday and things are really falling apart and you need to filter your water so you don't get diarrhea and giardia all the time, then you better do it. But you don't really need to practice that ahead of time.
What about starting a fire or?
Starting a fire, you need to practice. And going in the backcountry is one of the best things to practice right off the bat, is a little backpacking and camping. Start with car camping if you've never done it before, and then shift to backpacking. I give you the basics in my book, and then I tell you where to go, what are the best books to cover these subjects. And what that teaches you, when you're carrying everything on your back for a few days, you learn in a hurry what things you didn't use, and you said, man, I'm not going to carry that next time because I didn't need that. And what things you did need. You know, when you're out there and maybe it rains and you get wet and cold, it's like, okay, I need better rain gear. I need to be better prepared for this. I need a sleeping bag that's not down, that's a fiberfill bag, so if it gets wet, it keeps me warm. And I give that kind of advice in the book, but there's nothing like doing it. You know, it hardens your shoulders. It hardens your feet. Your body gets used to carrying things. That's the great thing to do. Having a garden, starting if you're in an apartment, starting a indoor garden and some south-facing windows gets you used to tending plants and growing some food and having some fresh veggies, or gardening in your backyard. Use the grow biointensive practices I teach in the book for how to grow a huge amount of food in a small space, and your soil will get richer and your garden will produce better year after year. You'll be building soil naturally with these techniques rather than depleting your soil. And those are powerful skills that are really good to learn and practice now while things are still working well.
Okay, so now let's go to the broader areas. I mean, you talk about, three levels, the personal level, which we've been talking about, the community level, and the global level. Let's go up to that next level, the community level. What are some kinds of things that we can do on that?
Well, in the community level, there's a wide variety of things. Like, there's a number of communities that are developing peak oil preparedness, like Portland, Oregon, and Boulder, Colorado. And these are communities that are looking at the coming challenges and saying, we've got to start putting infrastructure in place and getting people aware of these concepts so that when, even if we do the right things, we're going to have challenges in the future. And if we don't do the right things, we're going to have horrendous challenges. It's kind of like doing it right means you have significant challenges, and doing it wrong means you have horrendous challenges. So on the community level, there's strength in community. There's community-based energy co-ops. In Europe, they have communities that group together and invest in wind turbines or biofuels or solar farms, those kinds of things. So on the community-based level, you can start organizing your community to have your grid locally supported with locally generated power. You're much less susceptible to major meltdowns if you have that kind of infrastructure locally and you're not dependent on some coal-fired power plant that's 200 miles away, that if the coal's not running or something's happened or a terrorist act or an earthquake, whatever, and that's gone, then your local power is totally gone.
So you're saying that people should get together as, residents or get together with their local government to put in community locally based energy systems?
Yes, that's correct. You can team up with your local government and with your local concerned communities to start saying, we're going to invest locally. And for one thing, when you invest locally, you have the multiplier effect on those dollars. Every dollar that you spend out of the area, which is killing our country because we're sending $2 billion a day offshore in America to buy foreign oil. When you start investing in locally generated power, whether it's geothermal or whether it's biofuels or whether it's energy, it's wind or solar, then those dollars start paying people to operate and build those services locally, and then those guys go out and they buy food at the restaurants, they buy food at the stores, and it keeps the money circulating around the community. So anytime you can invest locally, and that's the key to rebuilding America, is to start investing in the infrastructure in America to get us off the coal and oil habit and to start rebuilding our homes and our industries for energy efficiency. You know, now imagine if you have a local program so that you can go out and get a low-interest loan so that you can hire a local carpenter to come in and add an insulating foam layer to the outside of your home and put energy-efficient appliances in the home and solar panels to generate your hot water. Now, all of a sudden, you're paying much less on your energy bill, and the interest you pay on that loan is going to be saved every month in your bills, and you're reducing your carbon footprint, and you're recirculating dollars throughout your community. So that is a community-based program. Now, naturally, if we can get the federal government to support it, great. But if you can't, then work with your local community. And also, there's strength in numbers. You know, when there's a crisis, the media tends to focus on the negative. They tend to focus on people who are raping or pillaging and, you know, looting stores, that kind of thing. But realistically, 19 out of 20 people in a crisis situation, it brings out the best in people. People reach out their hand to their neighbor. I remember seeing pictures when the Cypress Freeway collapsed in Oakland of homeless people who were alcoholic and indigent, and they rose to the occasion, and they were crawling through the wreckage in the Cypress Freeway, helping to save lives, risking their own lives in the collapsed freeway from the earthquake, and pulling people out of wreckage and locating people trapped in their cars so they could get machinery in to, you know, demolish the concrete on top of them and save their lives. So when a crisis happens, a strong community is a big boon. It's a huge help because not everyone knows everything. Not everyone has all the skills and all the materials themselves. So the shared community spirit, when you share skills, you share talents, you share materials, that's the key to success. And I think that the key to surviving our future is building self-reliant communities where people come together. I think now you're seeing a huge wave of hope in this country with the recent election with Obama and people saying, you know, we're gonna change. We're going to do things differently. And I think that on a community and national level, it was necessary that we had such hard times so that now we're willing to make significant changes to avoid collapse in the future. I think without those difficult times, we wouldn't be willing to support the broad, sweeping kinds of changes that are necessary to make a sustainable future in this planet and on this country.
Well, in your last chapter, you devote some energy to some of those changes. You talk about an idea or a concept called the natural step. Tell us what is that natural step?
Well, the natural step is developed by a Swedish guy, and it spread around the world. He looked at the natural systems of the planet and defined sustainability and said, you know, if we're going to live if we're going to make it in the long haul, we have to change the way we do things. We have to model ourselves after nature. We have to do things in sustainable ways. And that basically says that any process, any industry, if it's going to be sustainable, it has to not be contributing to the toxicity of the planet at a greater rate than the planet can absorb and detoxify itself. And if we're going to consume any materials that are non-sustainable, in other words, non-renewable, like anytime you burn coal, well, that's a fossil fuel it took millions of years to generate. Anytime you burn oil, it's a fossil fuel it took millions of years to generate, or gas, same thing. Anytime you consume non-renewable materials, in order to do it sustainably, you have to be building the infrastructure so that what you're getting out of those non-renewables, you're building an infrastructure so that it can use renewables over the long haul to provide that service. So what that means is we're burning coal, we're burning oil, we're burning natural gas. If we use some of that to build the windmills, to build the solar cells, to build the technologies that are reliant on renewable energies, then that's a sustainable use of those non-renewables. That's a sustainable use of them. So the natural step looks at all of our, it looks at industry and processes and defines them, you know, restructures them to be sustainable in the long run. Now, one of the key things they do this is called backcasting. In other words, if you're looking at the way we've always done things and project that out into the future, you're not going to, you don't tend to find the creative solutions to do things in radical new ways to make that sustainability shift. So backcasting is where, is a very powerful process where people get together, like say in an industry think group, and they get together and they say, okay, let's picture the end result. Let's picture ourselves having this paper mill and doing it sustainably, and the effluent from the paper mill is totally clean and pure and drinkable water, and there's no pollution going out the stack. And then you say, okay, I can see this end. Now you say, how did we get there? And you start going backwards and seeing in your mind's eye with this intuitive visioning process, you start seeing how you got to that end result that you want to get. And then often through that process, then people come up with radical new ways of doing things by going backwards from the end result that they want to get.
Well, that sounds a way to think positively about the future instead of just dwell on the catastrophes. And you really cover both sides of that, Matthew Stein, in your book, When Technology Fails. Now, Obama has pledged to tackle climate change and get the U.S. on the path to a greener economy. So what's number one on your wish list for Obama? And what is number one on your wish list for each one of us?
Well, for Obama, my wish list is that we change the tax structure. And that is just so vitally important. See, back in the 1970s, Jimmy Carter, who was had an engineering background, was training to be the commander of a nuclear submarine and was a brilliant guy, and he could vision what was happening to this country. He saw, as an engineer, the natural result of depletion of fossil fuels and that we needed to get off this. And he implemented a program to use tax rebates to support renewable energy investment. And you built up America's business in this field. We became the world leaders in renewable energy and wind and solar. And then that system got dismantled, and it caused a lot of businesses to crash and fail. Now, changing the tax structure is key to surviving our future. It's the number one most important thing, because we must make it financial suicide to do business in non-sustainable ways. See, the free market, if you subscribe and say, oh, well, the free market will save us all, the free market is basically a recipe for collapse. I mean, we've seen the financial result of unregulated greed causing a collapse in our financial systems. And similarly, unregulated greed will cause a collapse in the planet. Let me just explain this. If you're in an unregulated free market, if you're a CEO of a company, your number one responsibility is to maximize profit for your stockholders. And to do that, if you're in a competitive field, means you go to that part of the world where there's essentially slave labor and where there's no environmental controls, so that you can consume the natural resources of the planet for profit as fast and efficiently as possible with the least expense on your part. And you can't be worried about the environment, because if you spend more on the environment, then somebody else will come in and spend less and beat you in the profit game. So what that's doing is putting up the natural resources of the world for a fire sale. It's saying, come and get it, use up our resources, the natural systems that life on Earth is dependent on, and it's telling the world, come and get it, use them as fast as you can, make as much money as you can, as quick as you can, and destroy our planet as fast as you can in the name of profit. So changing our tax structure is critical, because if we do not regulate things for sustainability, then everything will collapse. And changing, there's numerous ways to do this. There's feed-in tariffs, there's tax rebates, there's basically where you look, you set a target and say, okay, this is our target now, and every company that's doing businesses in ways that hurt the planet more than this, we're going to penalize them, and there's some measurable way, and they get taxed higher rate, and then they use those extra taxes and those fees to support those companies and funnel money to the companies that are above that bar, that are working in more sustainable ways. So we must make it economic suicide to do things in unsustainable ways that are hurting the planet. And naturally, as the technologies advance and as we improve our industries, then the bar will raise higher and higher and higher. Because we're not going to instantly be sustainable, but we'll never get there unless we provide the economic incentives to get there.
Well, Matthew Stein, I think we've run out of time. We have abundant suggestions in your book that I'm sure each person who reads it can find some ways that they can start down that path of sustainability, and hopefully we can all work together to create that in our communities and our planet. Your book is When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice and writing this compendium of skills and perspectives.
You're welcome. And I'd like to give you my motto to close with. And my motto is to do your best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. Thank you very much.
You can find a link to 12 tips Matt Stein gives for making the shift to sustainability at writersvoice.net. The movement to make that shift is heating up. The day we produce this show, March 2nd, demonstrators from around the nation are demanding Congress pass tough legislation to curb greenhouse gas emissions. They're massing at the coal-fired Capital Power Plant in Washington, D.C. It provides the energy for the halls of Congress. In 2007, the facility spewed over 118,000 tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's, of course, a fraction of what's released by some of the 600 coal-fired power plants nationwide. This week, on the other radio show I work on, Sea Change Radio, my co-producer Bill Bowie interviewed writer and activist Bill McKibben, one of the organizers, about the national action at Capital Power. Go to seachange.net, that's the letter C, change.net, to hear that story and to find out more about McKibben's organization, 350.org. Its goal is to bring the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere back down to 350 parts per million, the maximum concentration to preserve life as we know it on this planet. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.